Hello. In episode 105 of AS for Architecture, Pier Vittorio Aureli speaks about his 2023 book, published by MIT Press, Architecture and Abstraction. An abstraction which goes beyond formal concerns and permeates the material conditions of building production.
AS for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture, and space.
Hello and welcome to another episode of AS for Architecture. I'm talking today to Pier Vittorio Aureli, educator, architect, and author of a new book, Architecture and Abstraction, part of the MIT Press's Writing Architecture series. Before we get into that, Pier Vittorio, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm an architect. I run a practice called Dogma together with Martino Tattara. And I also teach at the Polytechnic, the Federal Polytechnic School in Lausanne, known as the PFL.
What does Dogma do? Because obviously I know of it and follow it on various social media and see it. But what is that about?
It's an architectural practice. We do both projects, but also research. And projects consist into regulatory planning, urban design, but also architecture. And research deals with several topics, but there's been one specific topic that has been very important for us, which is domestic space.
Which you deal with, actually, funnily enough, in the book, Architecture and Abstraction. But perhaps we can come on to that. This book, Architecture and Abstraction, what lies behind it? Obviously, a lot of research, erudite, very thoughtful theory book. But where does it come from, and kind of why this book now? Why, you know, what is the timeliness, I suppose, of this?
Yes, actually, the book, as you said, has a very long. Let's call it origins, which are partly a personal fascination for abstract art. I mean, beside being an architect, I'm also myself a painter and have a great interest in abstraction, in what you can call abstract art, which of course is a very wide basin of artists and movements. So I'm not going to now be more specific than that. And actually, especially what is very interesting that many artists that were involved in abstract art, especially painting, were also writers. I mean, they wrote also a lot. Actually, I was really interested in the fact that they often made reference to architectures as if architecture, in a way, had already went through a process of abstraction, meaning a situation in which a building is not a representation of something else, as used to be in the past also for architecture. But especially with the case of modern architecture, architecture is what it does basically. It is actually a form devoid of any symbolism and any, let's say, representation like a staircase or a wall or a sidewalk or a road, no? So abstract painters were always fascinated by this reality, by this world devoid of any symbolism and any representation. And in fact, many abstract painters, like for example Mondrian, who is certainly one of the most profound artists in the field of abstraction. He always conceived his paintings almost as a sublimation of the experience of the modern world, where he said in a very enigmatic way, his writings are also very beautiful, but also very enigmatic, nature has disappeared, and now we live in a world that is completely man-made and abstract and devoid of any, let's say, drama, which is, of course, not very much the case, but by drama, he meant really this capacity of the world to symbolize everything.
This process of disenchantment.
Yes.
Yes,
I think that there is a lot of disenchantment, to recognize abstraction and the way that we live, we dwell into abstractions, so into an abstract world, is certainly a moment of recognition. And for many artists and many architects, some of them I also describe in my book, also a moment of disenchantment. Yes.
Is the idea of abstraction, particularly, I suppose, in art, but also in architecture, is this a uniquely modern phenomenon? Is it something that emerges in relation to the emergence of modernity from the 16th century?
Well, as I write in my books, actually, abstractions have a very long history, actually, that goes far back than just modernity. And as I describe in the book, it arises really with the formation of large-scale societies, which is a phenomenon that really goes back into what we can call very broadly prehistory. But of course, what happened in modernity, so what happened since the last 5 centuries, that this condition really becomes a totalizing experience, almost without any outside left, because in fact the whole world became this sort of totalizing system, of which, of course, capitalism becomes really the, let's say, the conditio sine qua non. So in that sense, you can say that modernity, I mean, abstraction has a very long history that predates modernity, but in the last centuries, actually, it became much more prominent and more powerful, let's say. Yeah.
If abstraction is, and correct me if I'm wrong, abstraction is an idea that of synthesizing the essential qualities of any given phenomenon and replicating that through visual formal aesthetic means. Is that a fair description of it?
Yes, to a certain extent, but I would say that abstraction, in my opinion, is not really an idea, although abstractions often are can be ideas. Abstraction is, in my opinion, is more of a condition that arises from the when you have to deal, when you have to organize very large quantities of things, you know, which became a problem, especially of what I called before large-scale societies. No? For example, the invention of writing, which was not something due to our needs to write poetry or novels, but it was actually a technique of counting and managing basically people and livestock when these things were in large quantities. So in a way, abstraction is really a necessity of this kind of society, and of course, many abstractions are originating from thought, from our capacity to elaborate and think. So definitely, abstraction has an origin in our ability to abstract things from the multitude of things that surround us. But its power, the power of abstraction, is social. In other words, is augmented by really this sort of condition, these large-scale social systems that push us to rely on abstractions, to rely, for example, on writing, to relying on calculus, to rely on many things that have a very strong social validity that you cannot question all the time. I mean, no one is going to question geometry. Although there is an history also of critique of a certain geometrical, certain way of thinking about geometry, but somehow some of these abstractions acquire a very strong social validity, like language, for example, like law, like and which you can contest all the time, you can change all the time. So they become actually very operative in the way society is organized.
What you seem to be describing is something that has deep roots within antique culture, within the Greek and the Roman.
Yeah, even before, for example, a culture that was very influential to the Greeks was Egyptian civilization. The Egyptians actually gave a lot of importance to what we can call today a bit anachronistically state authority. Actually, this prompted Egyptians to be extremely organized in terms of how to distribute resources, how to allocate land to people, how to organize bureaucracy, how to supervise everything that was happening, especially in light of this fact that the Nile would actually flood cyclically, and this even gave an even more exact tempo, if you want, to this.
What does it sit in contrast to? What does this abstract? Because it sounds to me, I mean, you could trace it back to, I suppose, a large number of cultures in the Far East and probably in South America and so on and so forth. There is evidence in the complex civilizations that emerged in there in prehistory and subsequently.
Yes.
So it almost seems to me to be under that understanding a kind of native form of what humans do. Like humans abstract things because we have this tendency towards communal living, and that lends itself to massive numbers, which is abstract. So what does it, but what does this like notion of abstraction, particularly, I suppose, in the arts and in architecture, what does it sit in contrast to? You've talked about figurative things, but like, what does that mean?
Yeah, actually, you are absolutely right. I mean, the so-called Western world, although I have little problems with this definition, certainly is not the only one to have operated through abstractions. But the difference is that in the Western world, especially in antiquity, in the Greek civilization, they reached an utmost level of abstractions, if you want, which was devoid of any link to religious or, let's say, even political authority. Think of, for example, mathematics or even Euclidean geometry, which is axiomatic, and these axioms actually relying on themselves, on their own self-evident logic. Now, in other cultures, it's true that there are, especially large-scale cultures, there were instances of abstraction, but somehow they were always kept under a certain, if you want, control. For example, something that I don't explain in my book, because this would have would open a very complex discourse, a way to which many civilizations have countered the possibility of abstractions to escalate was religion. In a way, you can almost argue that religion, which in a way paradoxically seems to be something very absurd, but for many cultures, it was a way to give to the abstractions an anthropomorphic, if you want, or a narrative form. What happened in the West, especially with the Greeks, is that this possibility of abstraction it's made autonomous. Philosophically and conceptually, but as Alfred von Rethel argued in his book, Intellectual and Manual Labor, which was an inspiration for me for writing this book, in a way, this investment in abstraction for the Greeks actually came from their beginning of familiarity with money economy, with actually the possibility to exchange commodities without bartering them, but really using, in fact, money. And of course, the rise of money economy implies that everything can be calculated, everything can be computed, and everything has to be assigned a value that is actually related to the way in which money, in fact, give value to things, which is at the end indifferent, if you want, to religious or political economies, although initially money as today actually were meant by powerful public institutions precisely to give to these abstractions a very strong, let's say, enforced authority, if you want. And that's why I think in the West, abstraction became so powerful. And of course, architecture was deeply affected by this power of abstraction.
Because at the root of this abstraction is the rise of money.
Yes, well, not just money, but the whole science and the whole reasoning that, let's say, a society that gives emphasis to economy entails. Now, for example, in my book, I explain, I mean, I made this hypothesis, of course, it's very, it's a hypothesis that I made based on literature, but this hypothesis that the emergence of the the Greek temple built in stone. You know that temples actually were first built in timber. And Vitruvius actually, in narrating the transformation of temples built in timber towards temple built in stone, actually he said that there was a gradual transformation. But in fact, it was not so gradual. It happens quite sudden. It was when many poleis, many ancient Greek cities, in fact, started to trade according to the parameters of money economy. And this actually allowed them to be, first of all, to have much more capital, to have much more, let's say, money to wealth to invest, but also to be much more precise, much more precise in demanding, for example, certain schedules, certain kind of, let's say, executions, a certain, and also to reorganize the building site, to divide the task. So in a way, the introduction of money requires much more precision, but at the same time, much more division of knowledge and division of labor than actually in previous societies. Because all of a sudden, there is this universal equivalent through which everything can be measured, everything can be valued, and everything can be specified according to certain goals.
I see. So, for example, if you are building yourself your temple, and you could say, I have this much available funds for this,
Exactly. Yeah.
therefore, I need to not go for a Corinthian column, I need to go for a Doric column because it's this much cheaper for this much stone, and therefore, an architecture is therefore made possible by this.
Yes, actually, that's a very good way to put it because we know that the very first attempts to write a theory of architecture, let's say, by authors that were that came much before Vitruvius. Vitruvius is the first known architectural theorist, but before him, as he acknowledged himself in his at the beginning of his first book, there were other people doing the same. And actually, we know that the very first attempts of writing architectural theory were usually memoirs written by Greek architects to defend the way they have spent their money, the money that were given to them by public authorities. So in a way, what we call architectural theory has a very strong, which is an abstraction in a way, because many aspects that architectural theory is made of are principles, are ideas which are very abstract. But in fact, the necessity of that is very material, and it was the discourse that architects produce in order to legitimize the way they have made certain design decisions and the ultimate, let's say, datum on which to assess this decision, what in fact money was actually how they spend their budget.
It ever was thus. I'm interested also, however, in this idea of abstraction in the much more aesthetic sense. The kind of when I suppose when we talk loosely about abstract material culture, we generally speaking have a set of images in mind: Mark Rothko's and Barnett Newman's and Kandinsky's and Mondrian's and so on. And I've mentioned only artists there and not architects. And this seems to be something now that we accept as a given, that architecture sits as or material art, most material art, and certainly critically acclaimed art is always abstract. When did this moment come about? When did, I suppose, abstraction win?
Yeah. Well, there are many, I would say, instances where abstract moments in which abstraction win. I don't think abstraction win only in the beginning of, let's say, late 19th, early 20th century. But at that point, there is a moment of acknowledgement that art can be uprooted from its social, political, symbolic context and appreciated as such. And this actually possibility comes from the invention of aesthetics. In my book, actually, I briefly explain how aesthetics came into being, so I'm not going to rehearse this genealogy, but basically, one of the consequences of aesthetics into art was the possibility to appreciate art devoid of any connection to its social or symbolic context. So
So
you
this is
can.
Kantian aesthetics.
Yes, and actually this is something that emerged in already in the 19th century, so even before the invention of abstraction, when, for example, critics could describe a work of art not for what it was meaning, but only for the composition of colors, the way in which the drawing or the let's say other features were organized in the canvas. Now, for us, this is very familiar. This is actually how very often we judge art. But you have to understand, we have to understand that before that, until the 18th century, art was never appreciated only for its formal aesthetic qualities. I mean, if you were a painter, you need a good story to tell. You need to, seduce people with certain symbolism. Of course, there was also a certain aesthetic pleasure in looking at art, but no one would be satisfied to just look to a stain of color on the canvas. Now, with aesthetics, this change because art is abstracted from any other context and develop its own discipline, its own, let's say, and of course, abstract artists are just arriving at the end of this process, somehow showing that a painting is valid, not for what it means, but only for how it's produced. Now, this is actually, if you want, the traditional interpretation of abstract art. But there is another interesting interpretation that I try to address at the beginning of my book, which for me was the starting point of writing this book, that many of these artists actually were not simply content to operate this abstraction of aesthetic features or formal features from any other aspect. They were also sublimating, I use this specific word, sublimating the experience of their own environment, the experience of the metropolis, let's say, or the city. What is sublimation? Sublimation is a psychic mechanism through which we transform challenging aspects of our life, sometimes also very negative, into something that we can cope with, that we can somehow deal with it, that we can name it at least. We can actually understand them. If we can solve them, at least we can coexist with them. And this is for me what abstract painters were doing. They were simply showing to themselves and to us the fact that abstraction, as you said before, has win, that abstraction is the very condition in which we dwell.
And so I can understand that in art. I'm always interested in people that are happy to glide between or accept the location of architecture within the realm of art, because I think that's quite an interesting and not untroubled kind of assumption.
Yeah.
And so I suppose it's quite easy to understand, say, for example, Mark Rothko, deeply troubled man, victim in many ways, and you can see it in his work, or Francis Bacon or whoever it is. You can kind of see this connection between the contestation, the sublimation of the modern condition and their work and their outputs. How is it manifest in architectural work, both in the outputs, but also, I suppose, in the processes of its production?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, and I try to answer that in my book. And maybe the best example I usually like always to talk through case studies, let's say. The best case study to answer your question is Le Corbusier. Because in Le Corbusier, there is a very strong tension between two tendencies. On one hand, his well-known invocation for the machine and industry to take over dwelling, you know? And I think this is very clear in this famous prototype of the Maison Domino, which we know that structurally was not going to work if it was built as he drew it in the famous perspective. But in fact, the concept behind was actually quite radical, which was to, in fact, provide any people, of course, they had to pay for them, the forms to which they could pour concrete and build basically structure for their house. And in a way, it's a clear project where the abstraction of building production is in fact translated into architecture. Of course, one source of inspiration for Le Corbusier was the factory, was the daylight factory, where architecture is reduced to its bare structure. At the same time, if when you look buildings by Le Corbusier, you see still the, if you make an X-ray, you know, in many of them, you still see the domino structure, but then he tried all kinds of formal, if you want, plastic interventions to almost shy away from this discovery of absolute abstraction that he made with Maison Domino. So it's almost as if he has reached this kind of 0 degree, this moment where architecture is reduced to its bare condition, to its abstraction, also to its, the process of production. But then he, in all his subsequent work, he tried to still retain his authorship as an architect. And of course, we know that Le Corbusier authorship is extremely present and very strong, as if he's actually moving away from this sort of moment of discovery of abstraction. And I describe that moment in one of the chapter of my book.
Why do you think so? Why do you think that the consequences of his position when he realizes what they are?
Because if the Maison Domino concept would have worked, which was not the case. I mean, as you might know, the whole project was not simply to make a design a prototype, but also to establish a factory that would produce the equipment. If this would have been actually a successful project, this would have erased the need of an architect, basically. He would have erased the possibility for architects to express themselves. And in fact, the image also that he used in the autocomplete, the famous perspective, is actually a false representation, because the idea was that then anyone could infill that skeleton with anything he or she wanted. So in a way, to me, Maison Domino is really a representation, not a realization, of that tabula rasa condition that had would make the role of the architect redundant. And we know that one of the consequences of, you know, the constant renewal of production, of means of production, often create, proletarize many professions, many professional roles. And I think Le Corbusier discovered that very soon, that if we really wanted to, if the machine had to be introduced in this process, the role of the architect was inessential.
I would like to come back to this idea of the proletarization. Proletarianization?
Proletarization, that's how I wrote it in my book. I don't know if I'm correct.
It works. I think we understand it. I want to come back to this because I think it's absolutely at the heart of, I feel, what you're talking about. But I want to come back to this idea of abstraction. So Domino House doesn't work, and yet it sort of works totally. And it's rolled out across the world, as, you know, with modifications on every housing estate, every, you know, it's the solution to everything.
Yes.
And it seems to me it's a very interesting moment. You have this great man, Le Corbusier, for all his failings, and there are many, a great thinker, a great designer, who has the authority to apply and to folk, to ordinary folk who've never heard of him, who never did anything wrong to him, this extraordinary kind of, as you say, abstraction. And it's not just an abstraction in the aesthetic or material sense, but it's an abstraction in the sense of an imposition of a type of citizenship, a type of humanity, in a way, on them, which does strike me as being like, so this issue around the emergence of abstraction does in its realization in architecture does strike me as enabling actually an extremely totalitarian top-down idea of what it is to be a citizen. There's very little voice in there for the poor, is there?
Well, I think in the case of Le Corbusier, I'm not sure, because his work, as I said before, is a very strong dialectic between, on one hand, the acceptance of the necessity of the industrial age, whether we like them or not. And of course, Le Corbusier took a very proactive position towards them. So he really celebrated them. But at the same time, when you look to his work carefully, and there are incredible historians that have done that much more than me, although I'm a big, I mean, very interested in his work. Actually, all his work is also a resistance to that, especially when you look to carefully to the project. Somehow this, what you call this sort of imposition of a top-down system in which humanity has no almost way out, is true to a certain extent. For example, in the there are projects where he also envisioned the possibility for citizens, as you call them, to self-build their own structures. Like, for example, in the famous Algiers housing, but also in the Mourandin houses. So, in a way, he is not, he's very tormented about this dialectic. I mean, all Le Corbusier's work is a constant struggle between these two aspects. The, if you want, the acceptance and to a certain extent, even celebration of the industrial age, and at the same time, the resistance towards it. And actually, I mean, maybe we are going outside of the spectrum of my book. A work of Le Corbusier where this is visible in the most dramatic terms is the Monastery of La Tourette, where you have an architecture that looks at the same time extremely industrial, where concrete is present in its most utmost power. But then when you look closely, you see that the details are very rough, that there is a certain almost archaic dimension in his work. And I know from a scholar who has done extensive research on the building process of the La Tourette, apparently the building site and the relationship between Le Corbusier and the building process was extremely chaotic, to the point that they had to improvise solutions at the building site almost without any design. So in a way, I think his work for me is still so radical, precisely because I don't think more than anyone you have this kind of split or fight between, you know, the power of abstraction to, as you said, to generalize everything and impose these generalizations to the world, but at the same time the desperate attempt to resist the implications of this condition.
You have a chapter in the book, which we've mentioned already, chapter 4, Without Architecture, The Townhouse, The Factory, and the Abstraction of Building Form. And I love this juxtaposition of these two things. The townhouse, particularly as you deal with it, the English townhouse.
Yeah.
And the factory, and of course, factory culture finds its footing most securely in Manchester, in England as well. And it sort of drags us away from talking about Le Corbusier, which I think is good, because he did, as you say, preference the designer. But instead, we have in the English townhouse and the factory something where the designer is almost entirely anonymous. And these become totally abstract ideas, totally abstract forms. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about how you make this connection between the townhouse and the factory, and what do you mean by the abstraction within those forms?
Well, first of all, there is a direct connection in the fact that many builders of terrace houses ended up also being, not always, but sometimes builders of factories. So in a way, there is really a continuity in terms of know-how. But actually, for me, what is interesting about this connection is that is really through these two typologies that architecture for the first time reach its most abstract dimension. The townhouse, actually, it's a very interesting typology that you can say they didn't exist in antiquity. It's also a very inconvenient typology because, as you know, the townhouse is basically several floors piled on top of each other. And its birth, as I also explained in my book, has a lot to do with the rising cost of land and the necessity to build vertically with the cheapest way possible in order also to make profit. So the townhouse is really a symptom that in cities, buying and renting houses has become a major economy. And of course, the city and the place where this condition escalates, I would say almost brutally, is England, especially after the Great Fire, where in fact houses were built not for inhabiting them. Of course, in a way, houses were not built by the people who eventually would live in them, but were built by speculators who were actually were leasing actually the land from landowners who understood that the business of housing was becoming very lucrative on a very long term, because they would in fact expect revenues much later, but they were rich, so they could wait. Who couldn't wait actually were the builders, who had to build the houses as fast as possible, as cheap as possible. And this completely reinvented the way in which houses were built. And the major aspect is that houses really becomes commodities. And every inch of their architecture, whether it's structure, whether it's fittings, whether it's entrance or the roof, is dictated by the logic of economy, by the fact that these are commodities, so they have to obey not just to use value, but also to exchange value. And of course, this sort of expediency that was developed through the building of terrace houses, at a certain point becomes even stronger with the building of factories, where this sort of need to economize became even stronger. And also factories were, from the very beginning, buildings that had to host an ever-changing program, because machines would change very often. There were a lot of needs in terms of internal management. So in a way, the factory really becomes a box with a minimum of vertical obstruction, where architecture, in a way, becomes more and more pure structure. Actually, it's interesting that first I make this example of famous factory in England, which was designed as a Gothic church. So there were these early attempts to build factories as monuments, because actually they were very big. I mean, all of a sudden in the landscape, you see these huge buildings. So people were worried. I mean, what is this? I mean, and actually people knew that, to be inside those factories was not fun at all. So there were attempts to build factories like monuments and like churches or town halls.
Are you talking about the old casting hall?
Exactly, which is actually a beautiful building that looks like a Cistercian church in a way. But actually later, this sort of attempt to domesticate the brutalism of the factory didn't hold, because of course the cost gains balance was at the end the only, let's say, principle through which to organize this space. So for me, that's why the townhouse and the factory are a major crucial, let's say, moment in the abstraction, if you want, of architecture.
It's a very, very interesting idea. It's a, and again, obviously these are both modern conditions. I suppose, if you go around Manchester, for example, you see lots and lots of factory buildings, or Victorian factory buildings, that have been converted into other uses, and they look like supersized things out of Florence or northern Italian cities.
Yeah.
On page 144 and 45, there's just this wonderful plan of a factory building, warehouse number.
Actually, not a factory. That plan is a storage.
That's right. And it's just you couldn't get more abstract as a plan, actually.
Yes.
It's absolutely remarkable when you have the word in mind. But why did they also then go along and make these buildings look like palaces? What was the idea? Was it the same thing that Le Corbusier finds in Domino House, which is the actual logic of this is terrifying?
Yes, I mean, you have to imagine that when the first factories were built, because the scale, because the activities that were being performed inside, also because the proliferation of these buildings, I mean, there were attempts to domesticate these buildings to make them looking familiar, let's say. The problem was that from the beginning, the factory is really driven by a very strong uncertainty about its future use. So, in a way, every factory builder knew that the kind of production process would change soon, and to a point that at a certain point in the 20th century, there is a very important architect of factories, Albert Kahn, and he really realized that the ultimate factory is just an empty space where which can be anything, which maybe one day could produce bombers, and then the day after become a shopping mall, and maybe after might be also housing. So in a way, this uncertainty is really embedded in the architecture of the factory. Also, we should not forget, and that's why I included that plan, that the origin of the factory is a storage. So the type, like unobstructed space, where the only vertical element is the load-bearing structure, in fact, existed before the so-called Industrial Revolution. It was actually the architecture of the factory. In fact, the name factory come from there. The early factories were not the industrial factories, were these buildings that were built often by, let's say, traders in order to store goods. They were often built in very, like almost like little fortresses, and they had a lot of capacity of space. But everybody knew that this space had to be as much as possible flexible because the fluctuations of its content were very, very, very strong. So in that sense, the factory really has this sort of, it's really embedded in this idea of what in the book is addressed as uncertain space, you know? A space that can be something one day and can be something else.
I remember hearing a talk at a conference, architectural history conference, in which the speaker was talking about factory spaces, and again talking about the phenomenon of the industrial era Victorian English factory, and talked about how the technology of the factory, the large span spaces, was an attempt to enable the same kind of visual oversight of the worker in spaces as would have been possible of an overseer in a field.
Yes.
And so it's a sort of like the technology follows the desire for this level of control. And I was wondering whether this abstraction that we're talking about, that we see materialized in our city production in the modern epoch, particularly in the last 200 or so years, is also not only a kind of pursuit of an aesthetic imperative, but also this idea of the alienation that's occurring through the modern realm, that what occurs in modernity is the alienation, Marx's alienation, Arendt's world alienation, and so on, many others.
No, I think the observation you made about the necessity to understand that to use the factory as a space of control is absolutely true. And in fact, one of the earliest person responsible to build factories was Samuel Bentham, who was actually the brother of Jeremy Bentham. So there is a strong link, there is a strong kinship between the idea of the prison and the idea of the factory. And factories were prisons in a way, because not only workers were very much under strict surveillance, but also they had to, their way of working was completely dictated by the schedule, let's say. And the supervision, so the supervision was very important. So in a way, this was another requirement that abstracted the space of the building to in order to allow this sort of co total control.
I'm just interested in the sort of the, I suppose in the material in design based activities, we have a sort of ambivalent attitude towards abstraction. We kind of look at it as a benign thing or just a thing. It's not something to append value to. But actually, if Marx's analysis is in any way correct, or other theorists is in any way correct, and this idea of abstraction and alienation are linked, then what we have in the abstraction of architectural space is actually potentially deeply pernicious.
Yeah.
That the big box that we have now, the Amazon warehouse, for example, is another manifestation of an abstraction of the human person, which is deeply problematic because it leads to all of the things that happen in modernity, slavery, holocausts, and so on and so forth. I mean, is that fair? Is abstraction in architecture actually has a dark heart?
Well, in a way, abstraction is alienation insofar abstraction becomes a form of dispossession of people's way to build, for example, a building. No? So if abstraction becomes a process, like, for example, the introduction of calculus, the introduction of geometry, and later the introduction of building techniques like concrete, reinforced concrete, if those techniques were introduced, and this is actually the case, as a way to dispossess builders, you know, what we can call traditional builders or carpenters, of their accessibility to their means of production, to their skills to produce buildings. Yes, abstraction is a profound means of alienation. So I really want to stress this point, because in my book I really make an effort to always historically understand abstraction. Abstraction is not a timeless condition, it's always historically situated. So one of the fundamental abstractions that emerged in modernity is the project. No, the project, you can understand it as an act of creative imagination by the architect, but you can also understand it as a dispossession of the agency of builders to build architecture. Because in the idea of the project, as we practice it today, every line you draw has to be faithfully reproduced in building by the builders. They don't have any whatsoever agency to modify or to change what is actually given to them, which has made actually their social and economic status extremely dire. And we know that very well from many reports done in recent years. So in a way, in that sense, yes, abstraction, the abstraction of, for example, the project can be understood as a process of alienation of the people who are then materializing. I mean, to give you an example, I know a friend of my, a colleague of mine, who told me that he has an enormous experience in designing very complex building. He's an expert of BIM. He's a maverick of all these new techniques. And he said, you know, in 10 years, I'm mastering these skills. I've never put a foot in a building site. So I know, you know, inch by inch where the iron roads goes into the concrete, you know, all these things. But I never saw how in reality, what is the labor, the suffering maybe that is necessary to realize these things. And this is actually really where abstraction becomes alienation. Alienation not only for, I mean, for the architect, but also for, especially for the builder.
Yes. I was looking on Twitter this morning because I'm a middle-aged man and that's who that's for. And there was some architectural cartoon about the architect bemoaning their loss of status, but also identifying all of the spaces in which they have acceded control or authority or even input in the building process. Mechanical engineers, planning, landscape, conservation, you name it. We've stood back and we've become very, as you say, very, very abstract. And obviously, the rise of the digital has only enhanced this abstraction, you know, the rise of increasingly things like BIM and so on. But I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about, there's this line that you used, the logic of the factory had penetrated every aspect of human life.
Mm.
And that, as you have just been saying, that includes the experience of architects,
yeah.
I assume. So the architectural worker has become subject to this abstraction, not just in this fact that they never go on site, but that they are then a small granular part, obviously, in the wider building culture. And we become less through this process. So abstraction is also a diminution of our identity.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, in a way we are paying the consequences. I mean, let's put it in a very simple way. I hope and this will maybe trigger people then to read the book. But in a very simple way, I would say that we are paying the consequences of this kind of Faustian pact that we made with abstraction in the beginning of modernity. I mean, we so much identified our profession with the idea of the project, with the idea that we are mastering not just construction, that is something for uneducated people, but we are mastering geometry, we are mastering philosophy, we are mastering, you know, the liberal arts. This was the big claim by wannabe architects like Alberti, for example, in the 15th century, although this tendency was present already before. And we should really be aware that Alberti is theorizing something that was already in a way in the making, as I argue in my book. And of course, this Faustian pact with abstraction, with the power of the project, of the power of an idea being before realization, its realization, in a way, now, you know, we are paying the consequences of that, because that Faustian pact implied a downgrading of manual work. And now actually the rising stakes of abstraction are downgrading not only manual work, but also intellectual work. You know, the so-called rise of artificial intelligence is just an annunciation of how many aspects of intellectual work will be further proletarized. So for me, it's not just the architect that is being proletarized, it's also intellectual work itself. In fact, I would describe our age exactly by the proletarization of intellectual work.
I mean, I don't know about you, but certainly I have encountered a lot of AI in the essays that I mark these days.
Yes, I mean, I think it's a form of sublimation, because there is a lot of anguish about it. And when there is an anguish, our way to cope with this anguish is to create all kinds of projects and ideas that can put in good use artificial intelligence. No? So this is exactly when the machine age started, when industrialization started. Architects were very anxious to give a positive form to it. No? Actually, Manfredo Tafuri called this moment the ideology of the plan, so that architects were trying to make out of the industrial, you know, restructuring of the world a possible project, you know? And I think this is a really an important mechanism through which architecture works.
If resistance is possible, if resistance is even desirable, let's pretend A, it's possible, B, it's desirable. What does it look like? How has it been manifest? Because it has been manifest, hasn't it? There have been obviously practices that look at material cultures, including the one material cultures, situated practices. This shift also, I think, in abstract art away from total abstraction towards something that is much more contextual, much more, I suppose, in a way, a little bit more phenomenological, a little bit more experiential. Is that how we resist it, if it's to be resisted, or will it play itself out? I mean, what's your prognosis as the expert in the digital room? What's your prognosis?
Well, I think maybe resistance is a too big word for me. In my book, I try to remain a little bit more modest. But there is an underlying critique in my book, especially in the last chapter, towards exactly what you said. I mean, that the only way to resist abstraction is to recover some sort of deep experience of places and space. Now, I admire this effort. I'm not a dismissive person. I think there is always something interesting in any approach. So I admire this attempt to resist abstraction by recovering the craft of architecture, to recover a certain experiential authenticity. I think there are, it's also an atelier that has produced a remarkable piece of architecture. So I'm not how to say hostile or in antithesis with that. But there is an underlying critique of my book of that approach that somehow, in a way, it's a kind of ideological, if you want, cover up the fact that this abstraction is so pervasive that even if you make the most authentic looking building, the process through which that building is produced implies a lot of abstractions. For example, a design, a project. So in that sense, I don't think that is a point of resistance. More modestly, what I try to propose in the book in general, but also in my teaching and in my work as an educator, is that we have to reclaim a stronger kinship between the technical knowledge of architecture and the artistic idea of architecture, because I think there is a separation now, and the separation is very visible in the way you us we produce, even in offices, but also in the work of students, we produce architecture by often separating the technical aspects. And of course, technical is a very limited word, but the nitty-gritty, if you want, of construction, of labor, of cost, economy, from the more artistic, imaginative dimension of architecture. I think that this is a profound mistake, in my opinion, which allowed an abstractions to proliferate unchecked. And the risk is that we just build a kind of smoke screen, ideological smoke screen to that reality. But the second thing that I would propose, and that's why I referred to Hannes Meyer curriculum for the Bauhaus in the last chapter, is that this technical knowledge has to be very much rooted also in historical knowledge. Now, this is very important because often technology and technical aspects in architecture are presented to us as givens. Like it has to be done like that. No? Engineers, not always. I worked also with engineers who have very strong, let's say, historical knowledge of their profession. But in engineering work, there is this tendency to accept the givens of the parameters through which something has to be done. While actually we know that technologies and techniques have a very strong history that is often rooted in conflicts, in social and political conditions. So for me, we have to reclaim that history and at the same time put it in relationship with profound technical knowledge of how buildings are made. And that's why during a conference, I with a lot of course, polemic afterwards, I made this provocation that any historian of architecture, theorist of architecture, has to be able to design and build architecture in order to be very competent in its critique or in its, let's say, discourse. This comes from a provocation by an Italian art historian, Roberto Longhi, who used to say, if you are an historian, specializing Caravaggio, you have to try, even if you are not a good painter, you have to try to paint as Caravaggio at least once.
That's a beautiful idea. I can imagine that went down pretty badly in a architectural history conference.
Yes, actually, it is because, of course, as I mean, I also myself a theorist of architecture, and we enjoy a lot the realm of ideas, and I think it's very important to maintain that realm. I mean, I'm not advocating for anti-intellectual.
No.
I mean, there's already a lot of propaganda about that in schools of architecture. So I'm really a defender of the work of history and theory, the work of imagination. And so when I'm confronted with the work of the students, I really don't want to oppress or frustrate their right to be creative, to be imaginative. But I think it's important that in that process, we reclaim this technical expertise. And for me, this technical knowledge is often completely missing in schools of architecture. It comes after, and usually when it comes, you are so you surrender yourself to it because it's so powerful, because it relies on where you know there the abstraction becomes much more visible, much more explicit. And because abstraction is always a socially produced force, you can't oppose it. You can't say, no, I want to, you know, do things in a different way.
Well, that's a fantastic point to finish on. Thank you very much, Pierre Vittoria. That was terrific.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Ambrose. And thanks to all those that will listen to this conversation.
As Sylvia Plath said, the abstract kills, the concrete saves. Sounds reasonable, but is it true? Read Pierre Vittoria's book, get a little further along the path of enlightenment. Thanks to Pierre Vittoria for the talk, and to the ever wonderful MIT Press for the real book. It's a beauty. You should get it. Links to him, them, and it are in the podcast description. Thanks for listening.